This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. Please subscribe if you haven't. You know what to do. Do it wherever you listen to your podcast. So you have almost certainly heard of the Babylon Bee, which is a hugely popular hardcore Christian satire website, or maybe I should say it is a very funny hardcore satire site that is run by Christians. I interviewed today's guest, the editor-in-chief of the Babylon Bee, Kyle Mann, back in 2019. After the site kept getting fact-checked by the comedically challenged fuss budgets over at Snopes.com, a website that I still go to and I find a lot of value in, it's a fact-checking site, but they have this hard-on about the Babylon Bee, and they keep checking its obviously satirical articles as if they were real. It's kind of a weird thing. The Babylon Bee is, I think, and I'm certainly not alone in this, is fantastically funny. And I find it even more impressive because they are hardcore born-again evangelical Christians who believe that the Bible is the inerrant word of God. That is just not a creed one usually associates with anything that's remotely funny, or at least intentionally funny, right? Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, they were all biblical literalists. And, they're not exactly people that you think about or certainly not people you want to hear telling jokes, right? Other comedy sites like The Onion, which is really the Babylon Bee and The Onion are kind of like, Godzilla and, Mothra of comedy sites at this point, of satire sites. The Onion doesn't operate under such an incredibly strict, insane, self-imposed stricture, I believe that the Bible is the inerrant word of God, and that limits certain things that the Bee is going to talk about or how they're going to talk about it. The fact that the Bee is so very funny day in and day out, they've been doing it for years now, is almost enough to get me as a lapsed Catholic to start believing in divine intervention. I will say this much. If in 5 years it's still as funny, I may even start believing in a covenant of grace, not works. Not there yet, but the Babylon Bee is bringing me closer and closer to believe that there is a God in the universe and that he or she or they are kind. I caught up with Kyle Mann in July at Freedom Fest, the annual gathering in Las Vegas, where we've done a bunch of wonderful interviews recently. I was especially interested in talking with him about the Babylon Bee's account getting frozen at Twitter earlier this year. It has been frozen and defunct since March, when Twitter suspended the Bee's account after it awarded Man of the Year honors to Rachel Levine, who's a trans woman serving in the Biden administration's Department of Health and Human Services. She had been named one of USA Today's Women of the Year. So Twitter said, hey, you got to take that tweet down. It offends us. It contravenes our hate speech policy or whatever. And until you do, the account is locked. And the Babylon Bee said, we're not taking it down. To be honest, the article in the Bee, and if you go to the podcast page of this, you'll be able to find a link to it. It struck me as a bit mean-spirited, especially for Christians, and not particularly funny. Something that I'd say it has in common with some of the recent trans joke stuff by stand-ups who are absolutely fantastic comedians like Dave Chappelle and Ricky Gervais. So I wanted to talk to Kyle about that. And in today's show, Kyle tells me that the offending article was intended to satirize media treatment of identity politics, not to demean trans people. Check out this snippet before we get into the main interview.
Obviously, we love trans people, and we love, we don't consider people like that beneath us. The Christian worldview is that everybody has the opportunity to be saved, and we can love everybody. And I'm no more deserving of God's grace than a transgender person is.
Right.
But when the culture bows down and starts handing out trophies to people for stuff like this, is when we say, hey, wait a minute, we need to protect women in our society as well.
So that's how Kyle Mann talks about the about trans people, which I find really interesting and I find genuine. I'm not sure if it will matter that much to trans people or other people, but I find him truly compelling figure. The Bee's account remains locked to Twitter because the publication is not going to delete the tweet and acknowledge that it contravened Twitter's policy against hate speech. Now, get this, though. In response to the Twitter ban, and also what Kyle tells me is persistent demonetization and minimizing of its reach of content at Facebook, the Bee has created its own social network and a subscription model, which it hadn't been planning to do. But both its social network and its subscription model is flourishing, which is a kind of libertarian response to getting shut out on a big platform, you know, that is private. And we talk about whether or not Twitter and Facebook and other places have the right to, you know, ban certain kinds of speech that they don't want. But the Bee has, you know, created a new platform for itself where it's doing really well. I think overall, and I think this is what makes this episode particularly interesting and compelling, is the whole episode shines a light on how contemporary culture wars are kind of being waged online. And it also, more specifically, it illustrates the travails that evangelical Christians face in a country that's increasingly secular and socially liberal. If you're my age, you remember, you know, a period in the late 70s through maybe the late 80s into the early 90s, where the Christian right, the religious right, the moral majority had a lot of cultural power and they weren't afraid to swing it around. That is no longer the case. More and more people define themselves as secular or atheist. People who call themselves evangelicals are shrinking. They're a smaller and smaller part of America. What happens when you have this hot cultural property, but you are a stranger in a strange land and your religion is no longer particularly welcome? We talk about all of that kind of stuff. And again, Kyle's a really interesting character who I think you're going to enjoy listening to. But we also talk about why he loves making fun of Donald Trump and Joe Biden pretty much in equal measure. But he saves his deepest, deepest, sickest burns for megachurch pastors and televangelists like Joel Osteen. If you're into Christian culture at all, you know who Joel Osteen and his pearly whites are. They are whiter than the gates of heaven, for sure, and more dazzling. Kyle also talks about why he believes that the left and Gen Z, they're not the same thing. He's not conflating them, but these two groups, the left and Gen Z especially, he says, cannot deal with humor that makes fun of them. And he also talks about why he loves, and I'm quoting here, personal liberty and personal freedom. Those are his terms, even when they create a culture that is deeply hostile to his faith. It's a good show. I dare say it's a great show. And in any case, ready or not, here is the Reason interview with the Babylon Bee's editor-in-chief, Kyle Mann.
Kyle Mann, thanks for talking to Reason.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You've been editor-in-chief of the Babylon Bee since 2016.
I've been with the Babylon Bee since 2016, but I first was just part-time. I was in construction sales and writing headlines before I went into my soul-sucking job.
And the soul-sucking job is at the Babylon Bee?
No. Construction sales job, yes. And the Babylon Bee sucks your soul in a different way because you have to read the news, you know, which is...
That is dead, right? Yeah, for sure. So when did you become editor-in-chief?
In 2018.
2018.
Yeah, 2 years later, yeah.
You recently tweeted something to the effect of you love your job, and you did a screen cap of the Babylon Bee from like a day or two ago. And I just wanted to go through some of the headlines and get your commentary on that, because I think it's a good way to kind of sum up where the Babylon Bee is right now. And like the main headline is in the well of the page, "Up Yours, Woke Moralist," cries Jordan Peterson while attempting to ride the ostriches at the zoo. That's one story. Also near the top is "Americans offer to trade LeBron to Russia for Brittany Griner." Time travel, and then subscriber headlines, "Time traveling Joel Osteen gives Job, as in the biblical book of Job, a copy of Your Best Life Now. Trump's children changed their last name to Biden so that media will ignore them." Why don't we start with those types of things? Like, how, you know, you said, "I love my job." Like, what's great about the Jordan Peterson?
Well, that morning I had spent an hour photoshopping Jordan Peterson onto an ostrich.
Right.
And there's these surreal moments when you when you're running the Babylon Bee, where you're sitting there like, am I really getting paid for this? Yeah. How does this work? You know, how did I get to this point? You know, even here at Freedom Fest, talking to some comedy legends like John Cleese, yep. and you know, you're just like, you know, people that are, you know, you're a distinguished interviewer, and you get to interview John Cleese,
yeah,
and you're like, you can have a sense of, well, I'm really good at interviewing, right, so I right. got to this point. I'm like, I Photoshop Jordan Peterson on an ostrich, and I get to talk to John Cleese. So what? It was a moment yeah. of the surreal realization that my job is so awesome. Like,
yeah.
we get to create this alternate world, and then write the newspaper about it.
Right.
You know. So it's such a fun, creative, imaginary thing.
Remind me, what does the Babylon Bee respond? What is that reference as? Because you guys are Christian, you're Bible-based evangelical Christians?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you believe the Bible is the inerrant word of
yes.
God?
Yes.
Okay. So this is all as a backdrop of saying you're being funny and you have tied five hands behind your back, because this just adds to the level of complexity. But what does the title the Babylon Bee refer
yeah,
to?
Yeah, so Babylon is a biblical reference to a time when Israel was in Babylonian captivity, Babylonian exile. And, you know, there was this sense where Israel had to maintain their identity as the people of God, despite no longer having the promised land.
Right.
And so that's where we are as Christians in America. You know, America's not the promised land. It never was the promised land, and yet we're grateful for, obviously, all the freedoms yeah. we have in America. And yet we have to go, but we're exiles. We're strangers in a different
strange
place.
Strange land, right?
But there's a sense of humor yeah. that comes with that. You know, there's a... You have to have a sense of joy about that, I think, to
what
survive.
What is the bee in that? Because the bee or the beehive has biblical dimensions to it, but it's also a very Mormon. The Mormon.
Yeah, there was no Mormon reference there that we were attempting.
I don't think so. Yeah,
it was a. It's got a stinger, mm-hmm. which is great for satire. And you know, we were kind of picking through different newspaper names, you know, right. the Courier, the Times,
yeah.
and Babylon Bee has that great
alliteration.
The alliteration,
and there's the Sacramento Bee.
Sacramento Bee,
I mean, it's not an unknown name for it.
Right.
So I realize this is the worst thing that I could be asking. You talked to John Cleese yesterday. I did, but so I'm going to do the worst thing possible and say, what is funny about a headline that says "Up yours, woke moralist cries Jordan Peterson while attempting to ride the ostriches"?
Well, yeah, because Jordan Peterson is riding an ostrich, so that's
what. Funny. What's your sense of Peterson? I mean, I assume that you like him because liberals and progressives hate him. They find him intolerable and just every extra book he sells, it makes their head explode a little bit more. but do you think he is, because he's certainly not a Christian, and, you know, do you like the content of his ideas, or is it mostly just that he is a flashpoint for the people that you dislike?
He's great for jokes, first of all. Being able to write in a voice like Jordan Peterson, whenever we write a Peterson article, you get people that are commenting saying, I read the entire thing in his voice, you know, because
yeah,
right. he has that
whiny kind of voice.
Trump was similar. Trump was great to write jokes about, because you write quotes in Trump's voice and people are like, it's exactly how he would say it. So he's great for comedy. I never really followed Peterson that much until, I don't know, a year or two ago, I picked up 12 Rules, and I thought it was good wisdom, you know.
Right.
It was interesting from a Christian perspective that he hasn't embraced the Christian faith, but he draws a lot of wisdom and applications from, and probably knows the Bible better than a lot of Christians do. Mm-hmm. So it's been interesting to see a mind like his kind of go on this journey. And he's come close to Christianity and then woven back the other way. And, you know, I think about if I was a contemporary of someone like C.S. Lewis, who was converted later in life. You know, he was this brilliant philosopher in his own right and brilliant professor in his own right, brilliant author, and then comes to faith, you know. And I see a similar kind of.
You're hoping
of
that
Jordan Peterson's
going to join your team at some point, right?
Well, and if we ever get to interview him, we'll try to convert him.
Okay. But, yeah. And C.S. Lewis, I want to get into your theology a little bit later, but isn't he a little too Catholic for you?
Well, he's Anglican.
Yeah,
so
but I mean, he's a JV Catholic, and he's a pussy. Like, he knows he's Catholic, but he can't be a Catholic because he's in England, and then that's a whole problem.
You know, yeah, maybe some of the traditions are a little more Catholic, but that's, you know, J.R. Tolkien's my favorite author, and he's hardcore
Very
Catholic.
Oh,
he'd
my
probably
God.
Hate,
that's
probably
why
hate me,
I was raised Catholic, and I can't read The Hobbit. You know, it's like I lived it.
Yeah.
What about the LeBron James, you know, American offers to trade LeBron to Russia for Brittany Griner, and she's the women NBA star. who's being held in a Russian prison for having weed vapes.
Yeah.
You know, again, why is it so funny to trade LeBron to Russia?
Because, you know, we're offering to trade him for Britney. It's a great joke.
Okay. And you always say that, like you never explain the joke, but it's obvious they're not equivalent in terms of basketball skill and whatnot, but or presence.
Well, LeBron is kind of represented, you know, for jokes. He's such a great punching bag because he does have the smug, like, I am better than everybody and I hate America, and yet America has given me everything that I have. So those kinds of personalities are great punching bags.
Do you think, and you know, for me, I LeBron James is like a fantastic athlete, and to the extent that that matters, you got to kind of admire that and give that. And then, you know, he was a rank hypocrite in terms of when Black Lives Matter took place, he said, you know, the NBA should allow or foreground protests by players about George Floyd and Black Lives Matter. And then when it came to people saying like, hey, we want to protest, you know, the mistreatment of Uyghurs and other people in China, he was like, you better shut up and you don't have any
shut
right.
up and dribble.
Yeah, is that, I mean, even as he was refusing to do that when other people were saying, is that the nut of why LeBron bugs you?
I don't even know that he bugs me that much. I try not to get too passionate about the stuff that we're joking about. Like, it's a great joke. And, you know, anytime you have somebody who is stuck up, there's and hypocrisy. And that's another area where that's great for humor. You know, anybody who's a hypocrite. And that's why Christians have been a great punching bag for
right.
years, you know, because yeah. people hone in on hypocrisy within Christians
right.
really easily.
Which brings me to the headline, time-traveling Joel Osteen gives Job a copy of Your Best Life Now. Explain, I mean, if you follow the Christian world at all, everybody knows who Joel Osteen is, but some secular people might not. Who is Joel Osteen and why is this funny?
Yeah, so he's a soft prosperity gospel preacher, you know, that kind of has this idea. It's a very associated with the word faith movement and, you know, the whole, the secret and everything mm-hmm. that comes with that, that you can speak wealth into existence. You can speak health into existence. Your words have creative power.
And also kind of, if you're right with God, you're going to do extremely well
right.
in this world.
It takes the Proverbs to the extreme. You know, it takes the Proverbs which say like, work hard and you'll be blessed. But the Proverbs are a general principle that say, in general, if you work hard, then you're going to reap the rewards of that.
Right.
But it takes that as this kind of like divine promise that if I put in the work, God is going to reward me with health and wealth. And it's really devious because it tells people who have cancer, it's your fault. You don't have enough faith. You haven't given enough money. You haven't done enough. And so we've, from day one, really punched yeah. at the
bright
gospel.
Shining teeth of Joel Osteen. Yeah,
he's like got great teeth. You yeah. got to admit that. Yeah.
I don't know where they came from. I don't think they're natural. They might have come directly from God or Satan. Satan has great teeth, right? I'm
yeah,
assuming
I
he's got a really good
in the
smile.
Yeah.
But Osteen, yeah, you mocked him. Like whenever there's a natural disaster, Joel Osteen in a Babylon Bee headline shows up giving out
a copy
right?
of his book. Yeah.
And then Job, how, you know, Job is obviously, you know, the one of the more interesting characters in the Old Testament. Just briefly recap, you know, why Job?
Yeah, Satan basically gets permission from God to beat up Job for a while, and he loses all his livestock and his family and his farms, and he's left with just his nagging wife and boils on himself, and it's
right.
almost a tragic comedy, you know,
yeah.
one of those dark comedies.
It really reflects well. Well, that's the Old Testament God,
yeah, right?
I mean, yeah, so.
Right.
But, so, Job just needs to buck up. Trump's children changed their last name to Biden so that the media will ignore them.
Yeah, and that's another right. example where hypocrisy, especially in the media, is a great target for us. Because everybody's sitting there, we all see it. We all see what's happening in the media, how they treat one side completely differently mm-hmm. from the other side. And when you can just shine a light on that, as
yeah.
our satirical newspaper does, that's great.
Do you, you know, I remember we talked, I think, 3 years ago. You talked to Reason a couple times. And you guys, you were hitting Trump pretty hard and things like that. A lot of people said, as Trump kind of went on, you got a little bit softer on him and you started going after liberals more. Do you think that's a fair criticism, or did your focus change for other reasons, or your focus did not change?
I think we went after Trump harder than we've ever gone after anyone on the left, mm-hmm. and we still do a lot of good jokes about Trump. You know, I think there's a lot of humor to be found in Trump. The problem with Trump humor is that the left was doing it so much and so poorly that it just kind of it didn't interest me anymore.
Yeah.
It doesn't interest me to say Trump has orange skin and he's stupid. Yeah. You know, like, okay, let's come up with something more clever. So when Trump humor can really play with his character and realize that he's already funny in his own right, you don't need to add anything.
Yeah.
And you can just
you
write
just gotta
something.
You got to get out of the way.
You got to roll. You got to roll with his character. Once we realized that, I think the Trump humor really became more fun like yeah. that. But when, we had a joke, you know, that said that people who vote for Trump are like voting for the Antichrist or something, you know. Yeah. So it's like we never done that kind of savage stuff on the left. So there was something where we were punching our own a little harder.
Mm-hmm. Do you consider Trump a Christian?
I don't think so.
Yeah. I mean, he says he is.
Well, there was a...
And he held the Bible, like, I'm pretty sure he had, like, a Teflon glove on because he's Satan, and if he touches the Bible, his hand would burn or something.
I think we did a bee joke on that, that he was rushed to the hospital with severe burns on his hand. So,
and when he was asked, like, what's your favorite book in the Bible, and he was like, all of them.
Yeah,
and it's like he obviously could not name Genesis or a single gospel.
Well, then he said 2 Corinthians, which is not how we say it. But I heard him speak at Faith and Freedom in Nashville, and he was making fun of himself for not knowing the Bible. He says, "I know I don't know the Bible as well as other people know the Bible," and I think he realizes, like, "Oh wow, I'm in the space where I'm a complete noob." And
why did evangelicals? I mean, they supported him incredibly strongly, and I realize maybe outside of your expertise, but you're an evangelical, you must know people who were like, "Yeah, I voted for Trump," but I mean, he is on a personal level, you know, he seems to be a despicable character. As a businessman, you know, everybody says he cheats on them and he's, you know, it's just awful. His personal life is a mess. He is a kind of horrible character. Why? And he is patently not a Christian, but got the Christian vote.
Yeah, and he was one of the few politicians who actually did a lot of the things he said he was going to do.
Yeah. So you think they knew that?
Well, yeah, I think maybe they got that sense from him. But also, like, some people just hated Hillary. I mean, there was a real revulsion to Hillary across the board. And, you know, it was that left versus right thing, the binary choice that, you know, I don't know if we didn't have that binary choice, if Trump would have...
There was a man named Gary Johnson who died a criminal's death.
Yeah.
The Trump stuff led to one of the most bizarre moments, I think, in my lifetime, in a lot of ways, where I like to think every once in a while, you know, that we're living in a Philip K. Dick universe, a science fiction writer who, you know, just, you know, where the world is insane in ways we can't fully appreciate. But you guys in, I think it was 2018 or thereabouts, you published a headline saying that Trump takes credit for doing more for Christianity than Jesus. And then literally a couple of years later, I mean, I guess it was this year or last year, Trump actually said, I've done more, and he said it a couple of times in different contexts, I have done more for religion or for Christianity than anybody else.
One in history.
how do you deal with that?
I just think he's a big, lovable guy that, you know, can... I don't think Trump takes himself as seriously as his haters think he does. I think he says these big boisterous things because he knows it gets a reaction. He knows it gets applause and laughter, and, you know, he's a character.
Yeah.
So he's a cartoon character, and I think he leans into that.
Do you want him to come back into American politics, are you a partisan? Do you?
I don't really care one way or the other. I mean, it'd be great for comedy. So I'll take that.
Okay. Although it's kind of bad for comedy, right? And you've pointed this out and other people
who
work with
you. Well, it's bad for comedy when you don't understand him. But it was great for us.
Yeah.
That allowed us to have this meteoric rise where we were doing great Trump jokes because the late night liberals didn't know how to do it.
Yeah. They were going very, I mean, the easy, obvious.
It's
not even low-hanging fruit. It's like
Trump.
His
name is not Trump. It's Trump.
Yeah.
Like that's comedy gold in the late night comedy world.
Why do you think late night comedy, even places like The Onion, which is still doing well, but seems to have lost something of an edge? Is it just simply that as liberals retake power, you know, because Trump came in and, you know, the Republicans were running, you know, Congress and the White House, they have the Supreme Court and things like that. That's gone. And does comedy suffer when your team for lack of a better term, is kind of running the show.
It can. I think you have to be more careful. I don't really buy into the punch up, punch down paradigm where comedy can only punch up. And so if you're if you're out of power, then you're funny. And if you're in power, then it's not funny because it's punched down. I don't really buy into that. I do think, like I was talking earlier about how Christians were such a great target because Christians are self-serious. Christians are dour. Christians have this obvious hypocrisy in a lot of areas. Well, I think that describes the woke liberal far left right now. Mm-hmm. Like that is who they are. You know, they're hypocritical in the way that they treat other people. And they say they were against racism, and yet a lot of their policies are racist. Mm-hmm. They take themselves very seriously because politics is their religion. You know, they believe in salvation, but they believe in salvation through wokeism, and they believe in salvation for our country, but only by voting for the right policies. Mm-hmm. And so, if you make fun of them, you're making fun of their religion.
Yeah. The Babylon Bee published a guide to wokeism or wokeness. What do you think, define wokeness briefly, and then what is driving it? Because this is something, you know, when people will quibble over stuff, but certainly over the past 20 years, but over the past 5 years or so, wokeness has become a real thing that is everywhere around us.
Yeah, well, I don't pretend to be a cultural expert or anything, but in my limited experience of what I've observed, it has been this like flashpoint in the last year or two that is just, you know, you heard the word woke kind of being thrown around 5 years ago, but it wasn't this big cultural thing where I can talk to my neighbor and say woke, and they're like, ah, I hate woke people, or I love woke. You know, now everybody on the street knows what that is.
Right.
But wokeness is it's a tough thing because it is a moving target. It is, I think at its core, it is kind of the Marxist-ish, and I won't say it's exactly defined with classical Marxism or anything, but it is the Marxist-ish idea that there's oppressors and oppressed, you know, and they just kind of take that and apply it to different areas, whether that's gender or race or nationality, and that's where you find all your misery from.
Why do you think that viewpoint has captured, if it hasn't become, if it's not something the masses believe in, it's something that the elite, particularly on the left side of the political spectrum, really is going deep on?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think there's probably a lot of white guilt going around, and it's a way to deal with it. You see that because they pay, you know, Robin DiAngelo $50,000 speaking fees or whatever to show up and tell them how evil they are. But I mean, ultimately, I think people need a way to salvation and redemption, and they need that narrative in their lives. And if they can say, well, here's my sin, my ancestors were evil, and then they can find a way to atone for it by doing better, I think that helps them, you know, in their mind at least.
Do you think it is, do you think American culture is becoming more secular and less religious over the past 20 years, 30 years?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a few, but I think there's...
Well, and I was going to ask, like, if that's the case, so maybe people, you know, maybe we assume that there is a fixed amount of people always want to find salvation, the phrase you use. And it used to be you found salvation through religion, and if religion is gone, then you seek it in other secular passions.
Well, I mean, I believe people are created to worship. I believe people are created to find meaning. And if you don't find meaning in the church, you're going to find meaning somewhere else. So people aren't leaving the church. They're going and finding their own church. Mm-hmm. And it happens to be the religion of wokeism on the left.
Right. So one of the things... you know, that is interesting is that you've been, you know, for years now, you guys have been in this interesting kind of war. And I think you all must own Snopes.com because when, you know, the minute that they started fact-checking you as a bad source, as misinformation, because people, they said that people were uniquely taking the Babylon Bee as truth, you know, and that needs to be fact-checked. Like, I mean, that gives you, you know, you get more coverage, you get more readers, people are interested, and it's funny. Can you talk a little bit about that? Why do you think there is a concerted effort, and it's not just Snopes, it's also CNN and whatnot. There is this interest in kind of delegitimating the Babylon Bee as, you know, I mean, it's a satirical site that can't be missed, but there seems to be this attempt to say, you guys aren't legitimate because people are taking you seriously, which is not really true to begin with. But then, and that means you shouldn't be doing satire.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I don't fully know the answer, but it does seem like the left is very confused by comedy that makes fun of the left. They don't understand it. Mm-hmm. They don't get it. Because they're used to controlling these cultural institutions. They're used to controlling the late night shows and the satire sites and all of that. And so when all of a sudden we come along and we have a, hopefully a good sense of humor and mm-hmm. we're writing comedy that people are finding funny, they think there's some like nefarious motive there. And that's what they always say in these fact checks. They're intentionally muddying the waters of a current event news story to confuse mm-hmm. people. Like that's the accusation that's made, which is so insane. Like we're writing very similar jokes to the jokes that the other guys are writing on right. the other side, and we're just writing them from our perspective. But I really think that they don't understand that we just want to put humor out into the world. You know, we want to put laughter out into the world. And yeah, a lot of it's going to come from our worldview or right. our perspective, but whose isn't? So I think there's a real confusion over it. You know, that we'll write articles that'll make fun of ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, where we write we make fun of Jordan Peterson riding an ostrich or whatever, or like we wrote an article that was supposed to make fun of really bad Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez humor, where we said that she tied up, she was trying to tie her shoelaces and she accidentally strangled herself. Right. And the headline says, because she is an idiot, right. or because she's so stupid. And we were really mocking the kind of over-the-top Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is an idiot memes that it just kind of became as stale as the Trump is an idiot right. memes. And people on the left freaked out and said, this is such a bad joke. You know, and we're kind of just sitting there snickering like, yeah, that's the yeah. point. You know, but they really just thought that we didn't have a sense of humor about ourselves because they can't comprehend conservatives that have a sense of humor.
Right.
Hey, before we continue with the recent interview with Kyle Mann of the Babylon Bee, I want to have a frank conversation with you. I want to ask a tough question. What the hell are you drinking in the morning? If you're like most people, including myself, until about a year ago, you probably start your day with a cup of coffee. But I don't have to tell you that coffee and the caffeine, supercharge that you're actually going for in coffee can be causing serious negative side effects for your health, your energy, or your mood. And as a result of that, I want you to consider starting your morning the same way I do, every day of the week, with a great beverage called Everyday Dose. It is great tasting, it's affordable, and it makes my morning something that I look forward to, even when the only thing I am looking forward to is drinking Everyday Dose. We know, I don't have to go on at length about how coffee can be bad for you. Coffee's super acidic. It can give you a stomach distress in all sorts of ways. It increases stress hormones. It can make you jittery or anxious or irritable, especially if you drink it later in the day. Coffee just, has a lot of problems to it. Whereas Everyday Dose is like the next generation of a morning beverage. It combines adaptogenic mushrooms. They're not psychedelic mushrooms, but they are good for you. Nootropics and collagen with organic low acidity cold brew coffee extract to actually increase your energy, heal your gut, and boost your mood, all without making you a jittering, jabbering mess. The best part of it, as far as I'm concerned, is that it tastes like coffee. I still get to enjoy my morning ritual of a piping hot cup of something that I can add milk or cream or whatever I want to. It boosts my energy. It helps my focus. It strengthens my immunity. It enhances my mood. It's helped me sleep better because I'm taking less caffeine in during the day. Everyday Dose is made from real USDA certified organic mushrooms. This means it has a 100% fruiting body and is double extracted for increased bioavailability, which is a really fancy way of saying that everything that is good in the mushrooms for your mood and your energy and everything gets absorbed pretty easily. This is the only mushroom coffee on the market that includes collagen and L-theanine, which are great for you, and it has a low acidity cold brew coffee extract that supplies an optimal dose of caffeine, just 39 milligrams per serving. That is great for energy without screwing up your stomach. And as I've mentioned, it tastes just like a delicious cup of light cold brew coffee, which is kind of great. You're not going to miss coffee. You're going to love Everyday Dose. So try Everyday Dose. It's an alternative to coffee that won't give you jitters, won't make you crash, and it won't produce digestive issues. You can try it for 60 days absolutely risk-free with a 60-day money-back guarantee. I've been using it for over a year, and I really like it. Just go to everydaydose.com today. It's all one word, everydaydose, DOSE.com, and sign up. In 60 days, you're not going to want your money back. You're going to want more everydaydose.com. And now, back to the recent interview with Kyle Mann of the Babylon Bee.
One of the, in an interview with The Atlantic that you gave last fall, you talked about how, you know, if you have to, you will, you identify more your humor with the baby boom generation, or you'll take the, you'll side with boomer humor over kind of zoomer humor, Gen Z humor. You're 35, so yeah. you're a millennial, and you're probably, I guess, maybe even closer to Gen Z than, you know, Gen X at that point. Sure. And that, talk a little bit about generational humor. And you, I think in that interview, you said that, you know, a lot of your readers are boomers, and they kind of get it in a way that younger people don't.
Yeah, there's a, well, you know, and I think there's a split. Most of the time I'm at a conference, people will say, my college son loves your stuff, yeah. or my grandpa loves your stuff. That's always what it is. They never like my stuff.
No, it's of course not. Yeah, they're holding a gun on you when they're saying that.
But, you know, so I think there's an interesting thing in that it does appeal to multiple people. But the, to me, boomer humor was this kind of classic Seinfeld, Cheers, mm-hmm. you know, and I know that's during the Gen X era.
Yeah, it's a 90 or
but
80s
it's,
and 90s.
You know, that's when boomers were 30 or 40 and we're watching that stuff and tuning into it. There's a classic, you know, just good old fashioned men do this, women do this. Mm-hmm. Isn't that silly? Observational humor about life. And now it seems like, you know, with Gen Z's humor, they subvert that and they say, no, there's no punchline. You watch a TikTok video, there's no punchline. It's something crazy happens and then the video cuts off. Mm-hmm. There's like a nihilism to the humor, you know. And I think absurdity can be great in humor, of course. But, you know, then they go and they attack everybody that built all these great cultural institutions for mm-hmm. comedy, you know, whether that's Saturday Night Live or all the classic sitcoms or Calvin and Hobbes. I mean, these mm-hmm. are things that, like, these are heights to which, you know, I don't think Gen Z humor can ever aspire mm-hmm. to be, you know, and we'll see what comes of it. But
yeah. Is part of it that older forms of humor and boomer humor, and I'm thinking like early Saturday Night Live, which is, you know, made by the early boomers, were parodying, you know, TV shows from the 50s and the 60s and kind of broadly held, you know, cultural templates. So people had a common culture. Mm. So you knew what the form of a presidential address was. You knew what the form of a sitcom was, et cetera. And like you can satirize that kind of thing as we get into an age where people have less and less in common or consume fewer forms in common, it becomes hard to do satire.
I agree with that. And I also think social media is, you know, it creates all these little subcultures. Mm-hmm. It shortens people's attention spans. You know, even you look at the format of comedy on TikTok, where mm-hmm. if you don't make the joke in 3 seconds, people yep. flip to the next video. You know, people used to have a longer attention span where they could track with a sketch that was 6 or 7 minutes long. You know, you look at Monty Python sketches that just go on and on and are absurd and don't have a point,
right.
but
yeah, yeah.
but go on and you're willing to let the joke develop and you're right. willing to let the little narrative arc build. And that's great. I also think that reporter was asking me about boomer humor. I just got a little annoyed because she was like, she was saying, oh, a lot of boomers like your stuff. Are you ashamed to be associated with boomer humor?
Yeah. Do you want
like,
to
why
come
would
out?
I be ashamed?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm a boomer and I'm kind of ashamed to be associated with them. But you talk about social media and fragmentation from a kind of religious point of view or from a Christian point of view. Isn't it kind of good, though, that we live in a world where the barriers to entry are pretty low and that a lot of different groups, I mean, this is part of the Protestant Reformation, and as it came out of England in the 17th century, it was kind of great that anybody who wanted to could start a church and had the freedom to do that. Isn't that somewhat analogous to, you know, the landscape we're in, where it's like, if you believe this thing, you know, whether it's religion or media or whatever, you can kind of create that world and try to draw adherence to your community.
Well, I think it's a double-edged sword. So I'm not completely down on social media. Obviously, the Babylon Bee wouldn't exist without
right.
it, because we were able to say, hey, you know, do you like The Onion, but hate when they are really bad at humor because they're too, you know, absorbed in the leftist worldview or whatever. Here's comedy that doesn't hate you, you know.
Right.
That was kind of the pitch. You're like, we'll make fun of you too, but we don't hate you. You know, that was kind of the way that it got popular. So obviously we were able to find a subculture using that we wouldn't have been able to launch the Babylon Bee on, you know, network TV or something, getting some deal there.
Or just through traditional print.
Or traditional print would be hard to find that audience too,
So let's talk a little bit about social media, because you've been in a kind of fight or a standoff now with Twitter. You still are on Facebook and you have a massive presence there, right?
Well, it's very suppressed by Facebook.
Okay. What does that
mean? We've been demonetized and deplatformed several times by Facebook, and they...
When you say demonetized, that means...
Well, like we'll get either videos demonetized. We've had, when we get those fact checks that come up, we get dings on our account where we can't monetize until we take certain steps.
Okay.
And we also have been told that our site is rated low for sharing false information. Mm-hmm. So now whenever you see BabylonBee.com, even if you share it from your personal page, Facebook flags that as like, this is bad information, we can't spread.
Although you have a large presence on Facebook.
We have a large following, but it's just our followers don't see our content. Yeah.
Okay. But you are on Facebook. You're active on Facebook. On Twitter, you were banned when you named Rachel Levine, who's an assistant secretary of health, who's transgender. She transitioned from a man to a woman, I think, in 2010 or 11. And you named her Man of the Year. And that triggered a Twitter response. Can you walk us through what happened?
Yeah, so we gave Rachel Levine a prestigious Man of the Year award, and we were sent a message a few days later that you're locked out of your account. You know, you have to recant. you have committed hateful conduct, and you are calling for violence against somebody. And acknowledge our hateful conduct policies, and click this button to delete the tweet, and acknowledge that you've committed hateful conduct.
And is that the actual language?
Yeah, I'm paraphrasing. Okay. I could find the original opinion. But
did they though? Say that this was committing violence or leading
there,
to violence.
If you click on it says, you know, you committed hateful, please review our hateful conduct policy, and you click on it, and it says calling for violence against people, calling for...
So it's part of a list, but they're not necessarily saying that tweet...
It wasn't typed custom for us, but it was part of that language,
Okay, so they said, you know, you got to get rid of this tweet, and then we'll unlock the account.
Right.
Okay, and you guys have chosen not to. Okay, can you walk us through the logic of that?
There wasn't a ton of discussion. It was very much, we got together and said, we're not deleting this, right? And it just felt, there's a humiliation, like bow before Twitter and apologize and acknowledge, you know, you're calling someone who is a biological male, no matter what Rachel Levine identifies as. And really, we weren't even making fun of Rachel Levine so much. We were making fun of the fact that USA Today named Rachel Levine one of their Women of the Year. And so this had kind of blown up on social media, you know, that transgender people have started to take awards away from biological women. And we're starting to erase that category in our society. And we said, well, you know, we're not going to delete this tweet. And we just kind of announced that on all the channels that we were still able to access, you know, on our personal Twitter profiles.
Stuff. And you have your personal Twitter account is still up and running.
Mine got deleted shortly after that. I got locked out as well. And then I was able to get back on.
How did you get back on?
I appealed it. And I had made a joke about something, how like, if the Babylon Bee had only committed genocide against Uyghurs, then we would be allowed on Twitter.
Right.
And they flagged that for violence.
Yeah. Did you retweet the headline about Rachel Levine
in
your personal account? Because would that have bounced
Whatever? I think pretty quickly we were like, okay, let's not share it on our personal pages, because if we do that, all of a sudden we're going to have no ability to access anything. But we'll leave the main account locked.
So you're talking about the Rachel Levine joke. There was a South Park episode shortly after Caitlyn Jenner transitioned. And the punchline of that was that everybody, no matter what, at every moment in the show would stop and talk about how Caitlyn Jenner was an incredibly brave, you know, and courageous person. You're saying that that's the joke, really, that you're making with Rachel Levine, that it's kind of the larger cultural response that you're parodying or that you're making a comment.
Yeah, it's the absolute, you know, obviously we love trans people and we love, you know, we don't consider people like that beneath us. You know, the Christian worldview is that everybody has the opportunity to be saved, you know, and we can love everybody. And I'm no more deserving of God's grace than a transgender person is.
Right.
But when the culture bows down and starts handing out trophies to people for stuff like this is when we say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we need to protect women in our society as well.
And do you think trans people have, or are they mentally ill that they want to transition?
It's probably, or? I mean, probably nowadays there's a lot of social, mm-hmm. a lot of social pressure as well as yeah. we've seen among a lot of transgender teens. Especially women.
So, you know, one of the things that's interesting is your response, the Babylon Bee's response to Twitter, like you're saying, okay, we're not going back on Twitter. And you seem to be holding pretty firm to that. That's one thing. And do you agree that Twitter, you know, has a right to kind of throw people off if they want? Like, you might disagree with it, but...
I'm of two minds about it, mm-hmm. because I see both sides of the argument. You know, on the one hand, yes, they are a private company, right. you know, and I don't know that I want to see a world where the government is sending regulators into, no. you know, bureaucrats into right. Twitter and what are you guys doing and give us reports on censorship. And anytime you give government that kind of power, you know, it only grows. It never right. it never comes down. On the other hand, if they are acting as de facto censors for the federal government, you know.
How are they doing that?
Well, because they're talking with the government. You know, we know that they're communicating with the White House about who they want censored and mm-hmm. and, you know, and all that. So, I mean, we had a person who was an ex-CIA agent come after the Babylon Bee for sharing misinformation, you know, talking about how she had been monitoring the Babylon Bee for sharing misinformation. And so, and then she's talking about how we just use satire as a shield to prevent ourselves from getting blocked.
But she's an ex-CIA agent, so what does yeah. that mean? Like, what's her
connection
to the government?
Well, the thinking is yeah. that that had been a pattern of thought within that agency, you know, uh-huh. is that people like the Babylon yeah. Bee are sharing misinformation.
At what point, I mean, because people used to, this is kind of faded, but it'll come back. There, you know, there's a distinction between a publisher and a platform or whatever. Yeah. But, I mean, because you would say nobody wants the government to come to the Babylon Bee or to Reason and say, you have to carry this speech.
Right.
But at what point then, what makes Twitter different that you might be okay with saying, okay, you know what, this should be treated like a public utility. It's like the old phone system where anybody can make a call about anything they want and you can't block that.
Yeah, well, and I don't know that I entirely agree with that argument either, that you know, the publisher versus platform distinction. I think that whole thing is a little misunderstood from a legal right. perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think
it's invented. It's made up. Or it's not anywhere in the
like,
in
like the 230 thing isn't the protection for social media that people think it is,
right.
I think. So I don't know that I entirely agree with that yeah. either. So I don't know what the answer is. But my feeling is culturally, no matter what you yeah. think legally, culturally, we're in a really bad place when the place where 90% of speech occurs is online. And it's all controlled by the left and big tech.
Yeah.
What's the answer? I don't know. I think we do need to build alternative platforms. I think we do need to build our own stuff. But as soon as we do that, they kick us off Amazon servers. Right. You know.
So, well, let's talk about that, because I think one of the most interesting things from a libertarian or from a market perspective is your response to the Twitter stuff is not simply to say, okay, well, Twitter's closed off to us and we'll just drop it. You have really robustly built out your online infrastructure. You have like more subscription plans and you're pumping out more material in a place, in an environment that you control, including, you know, creating a kind of social media network, right? That's part of Not the Bee.
Yeah, or Not yeah. the Bee Social.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Yeah. Because this is, you know, it's kind of like you got kicked out of one city in a valley and you're building a kind of shining city on a hill for yourselves,
yeah.
right?
That's true. Yeah, yeah. We built a little social network on the back of our Not the Bee website, mm-hmm. which is also kind of connected.
Right.
And it's a back end for both sites, you know. So that's what we're building out, is that you log into Babylon Bee and now you can share Babylon Bee articles with other Babylon
right.
Bee subscribers. And so, you know, it's almost a classic internet forum model
right.
where I used to be
yeah.
that we didn't all go to Facebook to talk about things. You know, if you were a hobby car enthusiast, you went to the car forum, you know.
Right, right. Yeah.
it was
so like
of,
use that and then various
So you're starting
other...
to see that fragmentation as people are,
yeah.
are doing all that stuff. So I do think it's exciting to see that because yeah. of the pressure that we're facing on social media, we just said, okay, well, we're going to move over here.
Right.
But at some point that breaks down because, like, you know, we could get cut off by payment processors
right.
or banks or...
Has that happened?
We haven't gotten cut off.
I mean, I agree with you broadly. You know, it's disturbing. And you mentioned Amazon Web Services. When back end things that nobody, you know,
you don't think about it. Yeah.
yeah, there's no reputational kind of value of, you know, when places like that get pressured to say, like, we don't want you carrying this website, even though nobody knows which, you know, who your back end,
right.
where your pages are hosted. That's totalitarian or it's totalist. It's very disturbing for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, we've had stuff like MailChimp. suspending us for a while. You know, we've had stuff like our email front end that kicked us off. You know, that it's hard to even make an appeal. Like, how do you go get subscription? Our email.
But then we see a proliferation of places like Substack that are, at least for the time being, explicitly committed to not being MailChimp in terms of like, we don't, as long as you are not breaking the law or, you know, we don't really care what you're writing about.
Yeah.
I mean, that's good, right?
I think that's a great thing. And I think that's a great adaptation that the market has made. I don't know if it's going to completely solve the problem.
Yeah.
But I also don't want government involved. So I don't know. I just write jokes on the internet.
Yeah. Can I ask just a kind of final broader question? I mean, you're a born again Bible believing evangelical Christian. You're a stranger in a strange land, right? Because, you know, what maybe 20% of America is evangelical, or no,
whatever,
smaller than that,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. But is there a real tension? Because, like, you know, you come from a belief system that believes in revealed truth that is absolute, that is unchanging, and that calls upon you to act in a particular way. And it's like, you're going to render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, but there comes a point where it's like, no, you're not going to participate. How does that feel? Like, I mean, are you waiting for that moment where you are going to have to, you know, kind of cut yourself off from secular society around you?
Well, the Christian is prepared for this because, you know, Jesus already told us, like, the world hates him. So imagine how they're going to treat you, you know.
Right.
But he also says,
let's face it, you're not Jesus.
And it's true.
You know?
But he says, take heart, because I have already overcome the world, you know. And I think there's a little bit of being based to being a Christian nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm okay with that. Like, I'm okay to not be like everybody else.
Right.
And so I don't think there's a fear or a worry. I think there's almost an excitement. The Christian church has always flourished under persecution.
Right.
You know, the Christian church is growing much faster in China than it's growing here.
Yeah.
Despite it being banned in China.
And I was thinking of that because we're mere steps away from Caesar's Palace, the casino in Vegas. And they have the Colosseum. And I was talking with my son about, I was telling him about the early Christians. You know, it's but do you feel like American culture in your lifetime, you know, there was a period in the 70s and in the 80s especially where the religious right, evangelical Christianity, seemed to be a growing and almost dominant cultural force. It would rarely admit to that, but it really was, you know, it moved politics in a big way. It created a lot of cultural phenomena that became broadly popular. Are those days over, or do you think, you know, is Christianity, evangelical Christianity, shrinking as a source of cultural power in America?
Well, I hope so, because we made a lot of bad Christian art in those days.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And I think I think there's a bit of a culling. You know, you're having a lot of people, especially during the pandemic, that stopped going to church. But, you know, we kind of wonder how committed were they anyway, you know? And I don't, you know, if we're attracting big crowds, but these people's lives aren't being changed and they're just there for cultural power, then we don't really mind, you know, that now we're kind of seeing who the true believers
now
are.
Now you're sounding like the certain aspects of the libertarian movement.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, we don't need big numbers. We just need hard people, right?
We need
true believers. Is there a way, you know, one story that we tell about America, and I say this as someone who's raised Catholic, you know, this was a story I was told, is that America ultimately was a place of religious toleration, and that spread out into different, you know, into a secular form of toleration, where the genius of the country really is that we have enormous numbers of people who come from very different backgrounds and believe very different things, some religious, some secular, whatever. And that kind of the genius of the country is that we can create a, you know, a governance system, not government, but just like a kind of operating system where as many of us can live peaceably together without killing each other. And, you know, you get to live your truth and try and persuade me into your group. I do the same. Is that a, you know, is that a version of America that is attractive to you? And then if it is, are we failing to do that though?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's great. I love personal liberty and personal freedom. And I think a lot of those values were thought up in the West, you know, because of Christianity.
Absolutely. I mean, freedom of conscience, the right to believe, you know, what you believe and act on that is like central to, you know, 17th century British, to the Reformation, ultimately to America.
I still worry, though, that the freedom, you know, that freedom still needs a common culture, you know, and that doesn't have to be, you know, a Christo-fascist regime or something.
Right.
But I do think there needs to be a kind of a common appreciation of some traditional values. Yeah. And I wonder how we manage that when the country is so far divided and polarized right now. Mm-hmm. You know, when we can't agree on what a man is, can we have that kind of tolerance and freedom?
What is a man?
I don't know.
No, seriously.
You know, it's XY chromosomes, you know.
Yeah. So. Okay. That doesn't get us very far, though, right? Yeah. But what would, you know, looking forward to the next couple of years, you know, certainly in the political arena, nothing's going to get better, right? Like we are, the only thing we know is we're falling and we're, you know, we're not near the bottom, probably, where we're going to hit. What are the types of things that might allow for, you know, a kind of settling of saying, okay, here are the 3, 4, 5 basic things that we all agree on as Americans. And then now, you know, as long as that's settled, then we can go about trying to persuade each other to, you know, you join my tribe, I join your tribe thing, or we come up with new tribes.
Yeah, I mean, and the new tribes may be the way to go. You know, I don't know. I increasingly don't see a way for America to reconcile beyond, you know, secession.
Yeah, which is not necessarily, it doesn't have a great track record.
It doesn't have a great track record. You know, The Onion wrote a joke about peace in the Middle East where they said that a new peace treaty was going to be 380 million little, you know, as each person has their own.
Right, yeah.
And now you just discovered, you know, individualism and freedom,
right,
you know.
Yeah.
And inadvertently making a joke that was pointing towards that. And I don't know, I mean, I don't know practically how we see that in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel like G.K. Chesterton had a quote that...
another Catholic.
I know, Catholic.
You're going soft.
The Catholics had the best quotes. Protestants don't do as well. But he had a quote about how all politics should be as local as possible. And he said the politician who... Keep your politicians close enough where you can kick them.
Yeah.
And he says, it's a shame how many politicians, how few politicians are hanged.
Yeah. Which maybe that could get you banned
from
Twitter,
kicked us off. Yeah. I tweet that occasionally, and it hasn't gotten me banned off Twitter yet. But that's, you know, I do believe that what we've seen through the pandemic is local elections, local politics, keeping things as local as we can is one of the solutions.
Okay. Well, we're going to leave it there. Thank you, Kyle Mann of the Babylon Bee. It was great talking.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Hey, this has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. If you liked what you heard, please go right now. Don't stop for anything to Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe. Or make it easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Not just for this show, but for our 3 other shows that are all great. There's The Reason Roundtable, a weekly podcast with me, Catherine Mangu Ward, Peter Suderman, and Matt Welch, moderator extraordinaire, hashing out the biggest issues of the day. That drops every Monday afternoon. Then there's the Soho Forum Debates, which is a recording of a live monthly Oxford-style debate over issues of particular interest to libertarians. Comes out once a month. Subscribe so you don't miss. And then there's The Reason Rundown, a new weekly podcast in which Peter Suderman talks to a single Reason journalist about a single big story or topic in the news. Drops every Friday, and it's a great way to ease into the weekend. Please subscribe to all of our Reason podcasts, and thank you for listening.